Welcome back to a very special edition of Cargumentative, where four guys who think they can drive are joined by a man who most certainly can. Six times national South African motorsport champion and F1 Grand Prix driver, Mr. Ian Schechter.
Hi.
Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. Fantastic to have you here, and thanks for coming out so late. Yeah. Ian, where do we begin? I mean, you're a South African motorsport icon, and I think it's probably best to just summarize briefly how you got into motorsport and how you got into Formula One.
Okay. A long time ago. I was at Rhodes. Well, all my life we raced, basically, bicycles, then buzz bikes.
You were at Rhodes?
Yeah, I went to Rhodes for a year.
You must have drunk a lot.
And in fact, I stayed at the Vic.
Oh, really?
So I was a pro at snooker and drinking.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Excellent.
And then a friend of mine had a 100 Yamaha twin, and we were both in East London. He was also from Rhodes. Mm. And he came round to the house and said, "Where's Jody? Why?" "No, he wants Jody to race his bike." And I said, "Well, he's not here, but let me go around the block." And I came back, and I said, "Hell, I'll race it for you." And that's basically how I started. He lent me the bike.
So on bikes. Excellent.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I did 4 years of bikes before I saw the light.
Okay. What made you see the light? Was it broken bones?
Yeah, was it an accident?
Well, I had a lot of that, obviously. But Jody did the driver to Europe in the Formula Ford, and I followed that series. We might have had one or two bike races at the same time. And the Formula Ford just looked bloody interesting and fun to drive, and I bought Peter Hull's car, who had actually won the series, a New Zealander. He left the car, trailer and everything, and for those days it was a huge R3,500 for the outfit.
What year was that?
1971.
And the car that you were racing, because I actually was reading one of the classic car magazines recently, and it showed a 1967 Formula Ford. And it's a gorgeous thing, eh? Cigar-shaped.
They were very good-looking cars.
Beautiful, beautiful-looking thing.
Yeah. So there was a
and they're very valuable now.
Very much so.
1600.
I think all Formula Fords are 1600. I think still today.
They changed motors. They went through a cycle. They went those Kent to those other later model cars. But we should have never changed, because Australia, New Zealand, countries like that never left Kent. And they're much stronger than we are today.
Right.
Much, much stronger, yeah.
No mistake. And then from Formula Ford to Formula One.
Yeah, didn't take long. Then I won my first race. I came third at Kyalami, and then I won my second race. I had pole lap record and won, and then I did that four in a row. So it looked like, I was quicker than Jody. In fact, I broke all their lap records, and it was straight after. And then we had the full driver to Europe at the end of the year, and Tony Bryce came out, and he was the main competition, and I won that. Okay, and then I went to England. I came back in July to see my girlfriend, and Gunston got hold of me at the airport on the way back and said, "Look, we want you to race for us, and they're going to pay a salary and bonus monies and expenses, etc., etc., and we were going to go Formula 2. But I had 1 week to make up my mind to accept it or reject. So I flew back to England, and it wasn't that hard a decision, because I was living like a bum in England. It was bloody hard racing there. Not that that worried me, but it rained and you worked in the mud, and there were no pits for the guys like Formula Ford and that, and cold and wet, whatever.
Who were you racing against in those days? I mean, were there any notables at Formula Ford at that point?
The biggest one was Tony Bryce, who came here, because he got into F1 and raced for Graham Hill, and then died with Graham Hill in that aeroplane crash when they all died. And he was looking like a star in Formula Ford. But in England, there was nobody at that time that really cracked it. And that's why I thought I came back, and I got a lot of opportunities in Formula One compared to what happens now. And I don't think if I had have stayed there, it would have been the same. Jody had set the path. There's only one Schechter, one African, it's not like they piled him up. So it was the right thing, because I got there. And then we went Formula One the next year here. And
so that's Gunston.
Yeah, Gunston in the Lotus 72.
And was that the South African Formula One?
Yeah, that, those days that was the championship. Yeah. I actually wanted a McLaren. Not that I had much choice, but the Lotus 72 was a beautiful car. One of the best to drive, actually.
That was what Jochen Rindt drove.
Yeah, but he died in the shame. Yeah,
he took the wings off. Yeah. It was at Monza.
Monza, yeah.
He took the wings off and in a quest to go fast.
Yeah.
And the car just was undrivable without it. And
so Mark, educate me. Lotus 72, what is that, a V8?
So I think V8
they ran that Cosworth V8 motor. You know the Formula One engine?
Yes, yes.
Which was around for a long time.
A very long time.
Very successful.
DFV.
DFV, yeah.
What a motor, yeah.
Yeah, and I was very lucky. 2015 was exactly 40 years from when I raced the Tyrrell, and Rupert's got the Tyrrell in his museum.
Yeah,
and they brought it to Cape Swartkops, and then ran it in Cape Town the week later, and I managed to drive it, and it was such fun 40 years later. It really was.
But I mean, just getting onto back to the car, I mean, that was the start of the wings. I mean, you'd just gone up in that DFE when it came out. I mean, it was massive power.
Yeah.
Those cars had absolutely no safety, and then all of a sudden you had wings that were being bolted on, so all of a sudden you can just go so much faster than before. I mean, it was a crazy era. Lucky that you survived it.
Yeah, a lot of guys. Well, my first Grand Prix, my first Formula One race, because they banned racing with the petrol problem in 73. So when I sat in that Lotus 72 on the grid at Kyalami, before I'd even done one lap of practice, they stopped practice because Peter Revson got killed.
So
you know, you can imagine a youngster sitting in a Formula One car, because in those days, it's not like we all know Formula One like it's your... You know, you guys know Lewis Hamilton like your best friend because it's on TV and interview.
Yeah.
In those days, there was no TV. So we didn't know anything other than what popped out once a year here. So when the guy died before he'd done a lap, I thought, what am I doing here? You know, I could be dead in a 15 minutes time. It was that kind of feeling.
Sure. But I guess, I mean, as soon as you get into the car and you strap yourself in,
then
don't have that fear anymore.
The red mist
evaporates.
Well, that first weekend, it was a bit, you know, I was a bit aware because I was learning the whole weekend and getting used to the power of an F1 car compared to F2. And but then soon after that, as you say, it was all behind and gone. But yeah, to survive that era, nobody would race for 20 years like they are now and survive. You would not last 20 years. You know, the cars are excellent now from a safety point of view, so it helps a lot. But 20 years in our era was
going down that old main straight downhill, which is where Peter Revson died. But you must have guys were going 300 k's an hour close, or at least close on it.
We were close to that, but you know, we were normally aspirated. But the cars were quite light. You know, they were 500 kilo cars, with close to 500 horsepower. Now they're 780 with about 900 horsepower. So power to weight ratio wasn't
It was great.
Yeah.
Sure,
not bad. Yeah.
So, wow. And I mean, were they quite forgiving cars to drive? I mean, you kind of had this idea in your mind that these were like snarling, loud, unforgiving cars to drive.
The Lotus 72 was fantastic to drive. You remember Ronnie Peterson used to drive it sideways, and the car actually performed better going sideways. And the aero packages we had in those days was actually just those small front wings and the back wing, which looked quite big. But we had no following problem. You know, like now they have that big aero problem they're trying to cure, because you can't get close to another car. Once you're within a second, you sort of lose your front end. We never had that problem because, I mean, I had to chase Charlton in the beginning. So we had barbecue Yuxke Sunset, if you know the old circuit, which were very, very fast corners. Now, today, those cars would be losing 1 second, 2 seconds, whereas there, those days, we were making up if you were better than the other guy. That's where you made up time.
Interesting.
And, Yuxke used to be one of those corners that you want to keep your foot flat, barbecue in Yuxke, so you'd like hold your leg, hoping it wouldn't lift.
but with those cars, I mean, the style of driving sideways, it's one of the great aspects of watching those old races.
Yeah.
Was that down to that was the style of driving in those days, or was that actually the right way to be driving the cars? Would the modern drivers be driving those cars the same way?
Yeah, because in those days we didn't have the aero package. Now they've got it. So the minute they go sideways now, they've lost half their downforce, and that's why you see in practice, and especially practice, even Vettel and Hamilton are spinning off because they're on such a knife edge. You know, our cars, were more forgiving because, like Clubhouse, for example, which is still around, and we had lovely curbs then. Like now, there's no skill at all because the curb's that wide. You know, nowadays it was just that. If you touched it, you buggered the corner up. And that corner, you actually powered. It was wonderful to drive like that because you were driving on the throttle.
Yeah.
Just get the, you know, the steering in the right place and power slide it to the exit, you know, which was
spectacular.
A lot more sensation. Yeah.
Guys, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to grill Mr. Ian Schechter some more on his F1 driving days.
Awesome. Awesome.
Okay.
Man, this aircon is racist.
For the latest political news
and in-depth discussion and analysis
on events making headlines in South Africa's socio-political space,
join myself, Amil Amrao, and my comrades from the Sunday Times Politics Desk for our Sunday Times Politics Weekly podcast. You can find new weekly episodes on the Times Live website every Wednesday.
This is not a shift.
Can you please come in?
Welcome back to Cargumentative, a special edition. We're talking to Ian Schechter. Ian, let's fast forward to the mid-70s.
Yeah.
You're overseas in the international Formula One arena. It's like probably the golden age of F1.
Yeah.
What was that like, hanging out with all those personalities and, you know...
In our day, I think we were maybe a bit more friendly than today. I think today they get very isolated in their motorhomes and the whole scene. Ours was much more laid back, I would say. But I think the racing was better then because we didn't have the restrictions they've got today. You know, today you almost should get rid of the drivers and put robots in because the drivers are penalized today for making a racing error. I believe you should only be penalized if you deliberately do something stupid. Whereas today, if you just pass a guy and you touch, they want to give you a drive-through. A mechanic leaves a wheel loose. The driver gets a 10-grid-slot penalty. We didn't have all that. You know that lovely saying, when the flag drops, the bullshit stops?
Yeah.
Well, that's how it was in the 70s, whereas now it's the other way around. When the flag drops, the bullshit starts now.
Mm.
I mean, all the, last year, that one race where the guys were kicked out for fuel.
That's right.
I mean, the one guy had a spike on the first lap, monitoring the fuel flow. Well, why are they bothered to do that? Say you guys have got 100 kilos of fuel or 200, whatever the figure is, and use it how you like. Why worry about how fast it's flowing? Mm. Now all you're doing is you're giving yourself a hell of a lot of work. You know, you're allowing them to try and work out how to cheat the system. Mm. Why do that?
It's like semantics almost. Well,
that's an interesting thing. So the cheating in the system, I mean, there are great fables about cheating in the days there. Yeah. Guys walking up to the cars when they're sitting in Parc Fermé to throw ball bearings down the exhaust to try and get to the minimum weight, fitting water tanks that were, because you're allowed to top up the fluids, so they ejected all the fluids and then you topped up with extra.
Yeah. Tyrrell was actually caught and banned for doing that. Yeah, he put lead in the water and poured it into the But yeah, I think I preferred the freedom more of our era. You know, the jump starts weren't really part of the equation. If you watch those old 70s things, I mean, the guys were half rolling, you know, at the start.
Yeah.
It just was, I think, more of a better era to race because we weren't restricted as drivers. I mean, today, they have a they give you a big patch of tar and paint a white line and tell you at 300 k's an hour, don't cross the white line, you know. Mm. Let them get in the car and see if they can manage that, you know. Especially the cars are so twitchy today. They grip like hell compared to what we had. But if you get slightly out of control, you're lucky to save.
I'm interested in the off-track stuff. So just a question. So were you more Niki Lauda or more James Hunt?
Well, James Hunt and I were teammates at Hesketh.
Right.
Yeah. I was more like James Hunt than than Nicky.
So you were teammates with him. Wow.
Nicky was always like he is, you know, now. He was always, how can I say, do you see the movie Rush?
Many times.
Many times. Well, they really picked those two guys absolutely perfectly, because that's exactly how they were. And James was a real playboy. I mean, he was probably the only world champion that really lived like a world champion. You know, he partied all the time.
Apparently, after the 76 win, he and Barry Sheen were holed up in a hotel room for a very long weekend. And it wasn't just the two of them.
Yeah, Barry Sheen was also a wild animal. A good guy, but also wild. Yeah.
And your teammate, well, you were teammates with James Hunt in 74.
It was 74 in the Hesketh.
Okay.
Yeah, but unfortunately for us, you know, there were no simulators. You arrive at the track for Thursday practice, and my car, it was a Cosworth, disintegrated the engine on the first lap of practice on the first day.
That's
first of all, that was a freak. But what really that did was it put all the rubbish through the radiators, through everything. So the whole day was wiped out. And then it becomes very difficult to learn a track and a car. And we had 35 practice guys, of which 10 didn't even get to start qualifying. So, you know, you really had to be, like today there are only 20 cars, and all 20 basically have to qualify. So we started with like 35, 36 starters, of which 25, I think, made it to qualifying to do the actual grid.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So fortunately for me, I made it every time in Europe. Alex Ribeiro, who was my teammate, he only made, I think, 2 in Europe, you know.
Oh, really?
Well, it was quite tough at the back end there, you know.
Yeah.
With the march, there were a lot of marches around, and you could see today, I mean, the back end cars have got no chance.
Nothing at all.
And it was the same then, you know.
And I mean, in your era as well, it was the time of the privateer, where somebody who had some money could actually pick up a car from a season ago or two seasons ago and actually go and compete if he had the means.
And
have his own team.
Yeah, there were guys like that, but you must remember that's how Frank started, Frank Williams. I mean, he was bumming parts all over the place and hopping up, because I drove for him two Grand Prix in 75. And he invited me back, and I didn't go back, which was probably the wrong thing to do. But it was very difficult. Here in South Africa, I had one of the best cars. Ken Howes was my chief mechanic, as I say. And anybody who knows Ken Howes, he's now in NASCAR, running Hendrick Motorsports, which is the biggest NASCAR team, and won 11 championships out there. So I had a real ace here and a real good car here, and then I had to go to poor Frank over there. So it was quite,
Ian, did you have a favourite track?
I really did enjoy the old Kyle Army. It was a great racetrack for that era. And in this country, the other one was Velcom. You know, Velcom was Van Goldfield's Raceway, not today's one, Pakisa. It's just such a pity that money in this country has become the god, and that's what happened, I think, in the Free State, because they could have spent some money and upgraded that circuit if they wanted to do something. And I don't know if you ever raced at Goldfields.
No,
I didn't. That long straight. No. It had fast sweeps, it had hairpins, it had chicanes, and it had everything. It was one of the best.
Interesting.
And did you ever drive at the Nürburgring back in the day?
Fortunately not.
I mean, that just looked absolutely terrifying. I mean, to drive an old school Formula One car around there in the rain must have required,
fortunately, I didn't have to do that. And the reason for that was because Lauda had his big crash with a fire at Nürburgring in 76. So 77, when I did the full season, we went to Hockenheim. And then Hockenheim still was very different
Hockenheim,
to today.
Hockenheim was that big circuit around the back. And were the chicanes still there at that point?
No, you had the chicanes at the beginning, but the top end corner was a Top Gear. One of those corners, should you or shouldn't you, you know. And Da Vinci, if you remember, De Palio was killed in testing, and one or two others, so they put a chicane at the top end. But now they've chopped that all out.
It's all gone. I went back there a couple of years ago, and it's just trees and forest and grass.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. No, those were good, you know. I mean, you had long straights, you know, like for miles. Yeah.
Unbelievable. And just in terms of driver fitness, I mean, today you always see guys out, you know, in the gym and jogging and cycling. Yeah. In your day, I mean, was driver fitness a big thing, or did you just sort of
smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know,
that's exactly what James did. Yeah. No, I tell you what. Our cars were probably tougher to drive.
Mm.
We were manual everything. There was no... Today, they, as you know, they got power steering, paddle shift, electric brakes. So there's not much from a physical side today other than the G-forces. You know, they're much higher than we had. So your neck would probably take more strain. But what happened was, I think Michael Schumacher started a regime of where you need to do what he used to do. And everybody's followed that. In those days, Jody was a gym fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
I did different sports for fitness. I trained with the rugby team because they were my friends. I trained with the Springbok Surf Lifesavers because they were my friends. So we were doing paddling into the ocean and back, and then road running because I found gym boring.
Yeah.
So I was fit because in my mind, I've always thought, well, if I'm fitter than the next guy. But then I learned a big lesson when I went to race with Sorrel in America. We raced that Porsche sports car March, which had no air conditioning, no ventilation, manual, everything. And boy, I couldn't handle that. I was dead in 20 minutes.
What was that, a 962?
It was like a 962. We ran the March chassis. The 962, 956 were better chassis, but we had the same engine.
Okay.
It had a hell of a lot of lag. You had to brake and accelerate before the corner and hope that the 650 horsepower didn't bang in halfway through.
Those were full ground effects cars, eh?
Yeah, they were.
So they must have also been very physical in the corners.
They were extremely physical. I mean, when we did the Daytona 24-hour, I mean, when it came to 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning and they would come and it's your turn, you know, you think, wow. You know, by then your hands are full of blisters and your feet are burning and sore. So I was quite fortunate in a way. Sorrel had just done a double stint and he got out the car bug and I got in and the car felt funny and they said, come in. I checked the car. They said, no, it's fine. I went out and the tire burst on the banking at Daytona.
Sure.
And I hit the wall and I managed to crawl back to the pits and they didn't see under the helmet, but when they said the car's finished, I was so happy. I was built for sprint racing, not endurance racing.
So out of all the different formulas, so you've done endurance racing, did you ever drive Le Mans?
No, I was supposed to in that same car, but I got a middle ear infection 2 weeks before. And you know, that happens, you lose your balance.
Yeah.
So I couldn't do it. I don't know, I think Christian Danner took my place at that Le Mans.
Sure.
But I wasn't too sad because I never really liked endurance racing. You did it because it was something to do.
Mm.
You know, somebody paid you to drive a car fast, so it was, you know.
And so, I mean, going back to Formula One and the 70s, you were, I mean, your career basically overlapped a whole bunch of technical advancements in the sport, which maybe were bad for the sport in hindsight. I mean, things like ground effects, turbocharging, those all arrived on, you know.
Yeah, we did in 77, the first turbo car arrived, the Renault, and 78 was the first. Well, 77 Lotus already had big wings. And I'm not convinced that those era packages were wrong, because IndyCar still runs quite a big undercar air package. And that has less aero effect than the wings, the top wings.
Yeah.
So if you really want to get closer racing, I think you might need to improve undercar airflow and have less on top, and which IndyCar have done. But Formula One never want to do what IndyCar
does. Because the big wing at the top causes turbulence.
Yeah, and different.
And you can't slipstream nicely.
Yeah, whereas all air under the car is goodish air. So that happened. Up until then, it was just all plain and manual. And as you say, some of the things, I remember Senna's one interview, he was there right at the beginning of the prop electronics, because when he went to Williams, they were way ahead with electric suspension and whatever it was called in those days. And he said, I'm not really sure this is good for the Formula One, you know? And that was then. Now, today, I think if he was alive, he'd be extremely shocked what's going on, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would.
Yeah. It's just so much electronic. I mean, you wonder, why doesn't Bottas keep up with Hamilton? You know, it's not that hard. You could just take Hamilton's printout I mean, you must see, I don't know if your Mustang has electronics. And you just put the overlay. I mean, Jackie does it, my son, with the Ferrari guys. And he says, look, this is what I did in the GD3. And it's on the computer screen. And then Marcel and Fabio, or whoever was driving, Craig Jarvis. And he'd overlay and say, look, you're braking a little early there. You're going a little late there and whatever. You know, so we had to do everything yourself by feel with one engineer. You had a rev counter and a stopwatch. That's all you had. So I did go through that. I think that I'd like to see Formula One go back to more basics. You know, Formula One have been telling us for a long time that they need to be the market leaders in the industry. And I think that that's history now. Because if they want to go market leaders, they have to go electronic. And that's already the sound is so bad that people are crying. That's number one. They've been telling us why they're market leaders. Have you seen a road car until the Valkyrie with the front wing? So look how much money they spent the front wing. Do you think Pirelli build tyres to do 10 laps and then quit? No. Yeah. So they in plain English, been bullshitting us a lot. Now they have to make a decision. Are we going to be an entertainment and go racing, and let's have that V8 screaming sound or whatever it is.
Yeah.
We don't need MGUHs and MGUKs that people don't even know what the hell they are and don't care what they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the on the current engines, they're limited to 14 or 15,000 RPM. Would they sound much better if they just let them go to 20?
Well,
the turbo engine, is it?
They used to have V6 turbo engines.
Don't think they would go to 20. That's the thing, they probably
wouldn't use it.
Although, I mean, I think the first batch of turbocharged cars were pretty spectacular. Yeah. They sounded wild. You know, popping and banging and flames and spark. And, you know, and that was... And
it was.
So and that started with you, Jackie, in what, 76 when Renault came?
Renault was 77, first turbo in Formula
turbo,
One.
Turbo,
I mean, those Audis, when they came out to South Africa, the Sorrel and then raced them. And
when
they changed gears, they're popping. And as you say, that's exciting. But the modern one isn't. And, you know, for 2021, they were promising us, we'll have the sound back. They've now decided to stick to the same engines.
Mm.
At one stage, they wanted them to get rid of the MGU something or other, and that would help the sound problem a lot. But now they've got manufacturers, you know. But where the manufacturers are and should be is in Formula E, and they are there.
Mm.
Yeah. So Formula One, if it goes back to just Ferrari and a common V-sounding screamer engine, we're going to have what we had in the 70s, and the racing was just as good then.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. What were those first turbo cars like? I mean, you were obviously in...
They arrived at Silverstone, which in those days was a great circuit. They had, you know, the top corners and the Stowe Club. You know, they turned it into a Mickey Mouse go-kart track. Now, they don't even pass on Hangar Straight anymore. Whereas, those days, that turbo car was bloody quick straight away. I mean, the 3-liter was history then, which proved in the next year or two or three it came. And they banned it, and now it's back again, you know.
It is, yeah. And you also saw that that Alpha ground effects car, which had it had like a dustbin-sized fan on the...
No, that was a Brabham.
The Brabham. I always got mixed up with Alpha and Brabham. But it was powered by Alpha.
They might have been...
That was a Gordon Murray car.
Yeah, but you see, when the Lotus had the wings, then, of course, everybody started thinking, now, how do we get that? And obviously, if you can seal the car off and have a fan sucking the air out, that's even better than just a flow.
It had skirting on the side that sucked it to the ground. Yeah.
But the trouble is the fan was blowing a lot of
turbulent air.
Stones and crap.
Were you in that race?
No, that's why I think it was 78. It was in Sweden. And he won the race
and they banned it straight away.
Straight away it was banned.
Because it had like, a 10-second lead or something.
They didn't really want them all to go that way. Yeah. Same as they banned the 6-wheelers. I mean, March and
but it was a Tyrrell.
The Tyrrell was a 6-wheeler front, and Williams and March built 4 wheels at the back.
Oh, wow.
And that was the right way to go, the 4 at the back, for the reason that the hole in the air the car makes is decided by the overall width, and the back wheels in those days, remember, they were huge.
Mm.
So by having 4 back wheels, you know, like front wheels at the back, you pulled the width of the car in by at least 2 feet. So you can imagine how much smaller that hole was. at Monza and tracks like that. But then they banned the six-wheelers. So otherwise, by now, we'd be running eight-wheelers.
Yeah.
Four in the front and four in the back.
What Formula One cars did you drive? Did you ever drive the P34, the Tyrrell?
No. I drove the Tyrrell and the Lotus 72, a Williams, the Hesketh, what else? That's enough.
Did you ever drive one of Jody's Ferraris?
I drove his Tyrrell for him. No, he didn't give me the Ferrari. He used the Ferrari himself, but I got to drive his Tyrrell. And I don't think it was as good as ours. It was from South Africa.
And if you could choose one to stick inside your garage today?
One car. You know, for me, the McLaren M23 was one of the most beautiful cars around, but Dave Charlton had bought one, and I thought it would be wrong for both of us in South Africa to have the same cars racing against each other, just from a spectator point of view. So we went and bought the Tyrrell that in those days. But Jody's lucky enough to have all his Formula One cars, original, repainted and refurbished, plus his Formula Ford, Formula 3s, Formula 2s,
wow.
5000 Can-Am car. Yeah. And they're all in a barn just outside his back door.
Cool. Yeah. That's what I like.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Guys, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, the conversation continues.
Young people are making their mark. Get up!
Tune into the Sebenza Live Behind the Hustle podcast every Tuesday to find out more about what fascinating careers are out there. You can find us on the Sebenza Live website,
or you can follow us on Twitter on Sebenza Live.
Sebenza boy.
Sebenza girl.
Sebenza.
Yavamdana.
Welcome back to Car Argumentative, where we're still interviewing and chatting to South African motorsport great Ian Schechter. Ian, I've got a question for you. You know, a lot of modern-day Formula One drivers, they have a pre-race ritual. You know, you'll see Hamilton, he'll jingle his gold chains and put his headphones on and, you know, zone out for a bit. Did you have any pre-race back in the day, did you do anything? Were there any quirks on a race day?
I'd spend the morning in the toilet. I had one or two stupid things, like I would always wear red underpants. I don't know why.
Okay.
Maybe I won a race when it was, I don't know. Yeah. And I always got into the car on the same side, sort of thing. But other than that, not really.
Not much. And did you, I think you may have told me this before, but you didn't eat when you drove?
No, I didn't have anything that morning or that till after the race. And I've got some beautiful pictures in my my business. And one of them is going down the Kyalami Strait as you come over the hill. And you see this brass smoke going across the track. Yeah. And I remember every time you'd come there, you'd smell those chops and burro.
I love that story. It's awesome.
Well, I mean, that's the 9 hours coming back, and we're all looking forward to camping out for the day. Putting the combi there and
Brian.
Scottle. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a great race with the GD3 blank pane cars. You know, they identifiable Mercedes SLs and, you know, the R8s and Lambos, and I think that's the right way to go for.
I think so too. I mean, I mean, they're cars that you can identify with, as you said, cars that you can that you can buy, and they all have their unique sound and the way they look and go about.
Speaking of identifiable road cars, tell us about road cars. Any favorites? Any history of what have you owned? What have you driven?
I raced for BM in 1980 when with the Sorrel and myself.
In the 535.
Yeah.
And there's a great crash I saw on YouTube where you just T-boned Sorrel.
What? You found me guilty before even chatting to me.
Plus, you're driving a 535.
But Sorrel was probably in the wrong place.
Yeah. He always is.
But from then on, I mean, I own BMs myself, and so I've always been a BM fan. Jody's a Mercedes fan, but I think that's because they give him a car every year. So I would also maybe swing a bit. The best car I ever really had was my 8 Series BM. I saw one in the 90s in Pretoria, and being a BM fan, that long bonnet, I always fell in love with it. And then a few years back, I imported one. I found a low mile, a beautiful one in England, and imported it.
Hey, what are your A50?
Sorry?
840 or 850?
840. And the reason was that it was a better motor than the V12, and it was auto, whereas the only good V12 is the 5.7, but they only made that with a manual. And in Joburg, I didn't want a manual.
I actually drove that very car about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Lovely. An 840 auto in a bluish color. What a lovely car.
Mine was black. Yeah.
Lovely. Fantastic.
What were those touring car days back? I mean, because that seems to be, well, I mean, you were in the golden age of Formula One, and you also seem to have been in the golden age of South African motorsport, where we had lots of money, we had great drivers, we had crowds, people would actually come out and support. What is that like?
Now, it was great. I've got to say, you know, I mean, for the last previous 2 years, I was the driver, whatever you call it, in GDC, so I was going to those races, but they diluted South African motorsport miles too much, you know, when they started having those split days. So in our day, they made sure they had only good racing. There were no club racing on the day of a national, and the guys came out. So, and we were lucky enough to have Formula Ones. Unfortunately, there's not enough money around to do proper, but we had a fair field mixed with 5,000s. Formula Twos weren't that competitive. And in the saloons, yeah, I mean, that was wild, that SA manufacturers, you could virtually do as you please. And, you know, Willie was there, and Jeff in their V8s, and Sarah.
And Morgan Rood, and
And Sarah was there with that Escort with the V6 Cosworth motor. So it was a flyer down the straights, you know. And,
I watched that today, actually. You and Sarah. 1980.
Yes,
you were in the 535. He was in the Escort.
Yeah,
and then it just ended. In what actually happened there?
What happened? Okay, I was South African champion in single seaters, and he was South African rally champion and done road race. Yeah, I'd never driven saloon cars up until that point, and so when we got there, I guess it was a case of who's better and whose ego was probably bigger. But the first real race we had against each other was PE. It was two heats, and it was amazing because, you know, PE is quite a tight circuit. And those cars, so he didn't get such a big advantage on the straight there because the straight wasn't that long, and my BM handled pretty good. So we were door to door, and then the banging started, and then I knew it was free for all. And fortunately, I won both those heats, but only by that much, and every lap we changed leads, you know, so I was lucky as well. Then we got a Kyalami. And the banging continued, and eventually something had to happen.
It's fantastic. I mean, if you guys haven't seen it, go onto YouTube, type in Schecter versus Sorrel van der Merwe, Kyalami 1980. It'll come up.
Lovely.
Yeah, excellent.
It was a great race to watch, actually. Yeah, I'm sorry I did bugger it up before the end, because it would have been a great finish.
It was a fantastic race. Yeah. Even the end was, I mean, it just had that drama, that old school kind of, you know. I'm going for it.
I was one of those kind of drivers that you commit, you know, if you want to pass, you've got to commit. It's these guys that pull up and hesitate, they don't go by, you know. You've got to decide, I'm going to do it now, and now's the time. And sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. But at least we didn't get wrapped on our knuckles.
Exactly, like you weren't penalized 100 points because you had a little,
stupid,
you know.
Yeah.
That is totally ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, you might as well put robots in the cars today, because you're not allowed to make an error as a human being, because you're getting penalized for just making a human error.
Yeah.
So you might as well put a robot in, but then you can go one step further and go driverless, so... You know,
well, that's the thing. I mean, where did Formula One go wrong? Where did motorsport go wrong? I mean, a lot of it has just become this procession, where it's more about the car, I think, than it is actually the driver. Because you can be a good driver, and if you're incredibly fit and you've got money and you've got backing, you can succeed. And I think that's different to how it was back in the old days, where raw skill actually counted for more than that.
Yeah, well, you had to in the 70s, especially, because that's where I did most of the Formula One stuff. It was really just up to you and your engineer and the designer of the car, really. You know, you'd do an adjustment according to what I felt. I'd go out and the stopwatch, and you'd look at the rev count and hope you saw 50 more revs, which you didn't really see. But the stopwatch would say, you know, you're 0.1, 0.2 quicker. Whereas today, they've broken it up into segments of each corner. You know, they've got it all on computerized and that. And we didn't have that kind of aid. So at the end of the day, it was really up to you and your feel and your engineer, how good he was and how good he interpreted what you said.
I think, by removing the human, they've made it, you can't relate. And that's why it's not as enjoyable.
Yeah, and you know, you've got the manufacturers there, and I guess that up to now, it's who's ever thrown the most money at the project. Yeah. Sure, Ferrari were as quick as Mercedes last year, but I think they self-imploded.
Vettel did. It was just inexplicable. The second half of the season, he just wasn't himself.
No, he threw it away. It was just frustrating.
Yeah, I think if you swap cars and those teams around, Hamilton would have still won the championship. You know, if he was in the Ferrari with his team, the car, there was nothing wrong with the Ferrari as a car.
Vettel just towed it.
And the team occasionally, you know, but anyway. Yeah.
We're hoping that Ferrari shapes. I'm a Ferrari fan, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, us too, you know. I wasn't a huge fan, even though Jody did do the Ferrari, but when I've been doing track days for Pablo Clark, and I learned to love the Ferrari. It handles like a single seater. It really does
handle very well.
It's the 360 and the 430s.
They're extremely fantastic. You know, and then I did a bit of the Masters V8s, which is back to the 70s, manual everything. They don't even have power steering, I'll tell you what. They're horrible.
So you get out of those afterwards, you're like, wow.
I would put a power steering if I had a Masters V8.
I went to the thing at SwartCorps recently.
And international.
And you know, you could see that the day there, it looked like there was 20,000-30,000 people. I mean, it was just packed. And I mean, we're just motorsport staff. So you talk about like that there are too many formally, and they split it up, and there's club racing on the same day. That there's a thing. How do we get back to something that resembles? Is it possible to in this country? Is there enough money?
I hope that they do it right, you know. When they split it all up, I don't know if the guys, none of you are young enough, but old enough, I should say. We had fantastic motorbike racing in South Africa, the days of Boshoff and Zeeman and Van Breda and Ophie Howard and that. So the two motorbike races were huge draw cards. And then when we had the superbikes with the Peterson boys and Gray and all those guys, that was a huge draw card. Now somebody got clever and said, let's take the bikes away, we'll go and race on our own, and it didn't work because those two classes can't entertain a day somebody on their own. So you need somebody to put back together a package of the best racing in South Africa.
Yeah, full day
of a variety the best of racing, yeah. And promote it properly. And I think, and maybe they need to find a sponsor and put some money up front, you know, because everywhere else in the world you race for money, and money is very critical in motor racing today. But we've been racing for fresh air in South Africa for the last.
And those hideous trophies, which you just put in the bin, it's in his view.
Well, I've only got about two left.
Unfortunately, guys, that's all the time we have in studio today. Ian, it was fantastic having you here and hearing all your stories and your ideas. It was quite something. So thank you very much for taking the time out and joining us here on Cargumentative.
That was fun, actually. I didn't know what to expect, but this was fun.
We need to do it each week.
I can do it again, but not every week.
We should have you back.
Well, maybe we'll do that.
We'll come visit you at your dealership.
Absolutely.
That would be fun,
Excellent.
Thanks for coming.
Well, guys, thanks so much, and until next week, keep it safe out on the roads. From me, Thomas Faulkner, goodbye.
Cheers.
Cheers.